Good morning, everyone, and welcome back to our weekly didactic podcast reviewing the primary care didactics for the Virginia Mason Internal Medicine Residency Program. I'm Madhani Mohanachandran, and I am joined today by my excellent co-host, Dr. Anant Shenoy, who is going to be our expert for today's topic on syncope.
Good morning, and thank you for having me, Dr. Mohan.
All right. Anant, would you like to walk us through a little bit of introduction before I start throwing some cases at you?
Absolutely. So we are going to be talking about syncope today. And if I was talking to everyone in person, I'd ask for a show of hands about how many people or how many of you have seen cases of syncope, or even experienced it in your own personal life. And I suspect everybody, yes. So for those who can't see, Dr. Mohan put her hand up. And I personally have had syncopal events. So yes, very common, very likely to be useful to you in clinic or in the hospital, where you undoubtedly will do the workup at least once a month and probably in your own personal life with friends, family, or yourself. So I think it's helpful to have a definition because syncope can get thrown around inappropriately. So the term really means a sudden loss of consciousness. And this is without exception due to a lack of oxygen in the brain, usually due to a lack of blood flow to the brain. And you have loss of postural tone. Basically, you go limp and go down. And then it's also part of the definition is there's spontaneous recovery. That is, someone doesn't have to shock you back or do something else. And the prevalence, again, it's hard to estimate, but as much as 41% and tends to be recurrent for like 1 in 5 people. So those who syncopize, there's a pretty decent chance they will syncopize again. But I just really want to drive home the point, Dr. Mohan, syncope involves loss of consciousness. Someone who doesn't have loss of consciousness is not having syncope. So I think if it's okay, I'm going to keep talking. This didactic was put together by Dr. Song, our illustrious Dr. Song. And while I think you're going to give me patient cases, I'm confident none of them will be actual patient cases and there'll be no protected health information. And I'd also just like to comment on our usual health equity spotlight. So Dr. Song was exhaustive in looking for examples of disparities in healthcare when it comes to syncope. And he found, I think, another very striking and really unfortunate example, looking at the diagnostic testing and workup of acute care encounters for a set of diagnoses which included syncope. And basically, in this study, what they found is that Black patients had significantly lower odds than white patients of having diagnostic testing for their specific condition, again, one of which was syncope. And so, you know, you could look at that a couple different ways. One would be to say maybe it's because white patients were more likely to be overtested, but of course, the other very likely explanation is that Black patients were less likely to be tested. And as always, we don't highlight these examples to make anybody feel bad. That is not the point. It is so that each of us in our own practice, we are more mindful because each of us have a role in correcting this and changing it in our own practice. So that's just the intro I'd like to give, Dr. Mohan. I will turn it back over to you.
All right. Well, very well said. And yes, so we are going to go on to cases. So your first case is a 54-year-old patient who comes in with a routine hypertension follow-up accompanied by his wife. He has a history of hyperlipidemia, acid reflux, and hypertension on ARB and a thiazide diuretic. He does not check his blood pressure readings at home. His wife tells you that 3 days ago, they were out working in the yard when he passed out. She wanted him to go to the emergency room. He refused knowing he had a visit coming up with you today. I have heard this story so many times in clinic. So first off, what is your differential diagnosis of syncope?
Yes. And I indeed have also had this literal clinical scenario a number of times. So the differential diagnosis of syncope, I think again, and I hate to be a broken record, but we want to be really clear on what syncope is. Again, recalling that that is involving a sudden loss of consciousness due to hypoperfusion of the brain. And it is helpful to tease that out from seizure because generally with syncope, true loss of consciousness, seizure is also going to be on your differential. Some of the helpful things when we think about teasing out syncope versus seizure is that generally there is a prodrome that goes with syncope. Often, but not always, people will feel nauseous and they'll get diaphoretic. In contrast, seizures sometimes have an aura. And we'll talk more about that too in our headache discussion, our migraine headache discussion, which I think is a different didactic for a different day. But recall that auras can be altered perceptions of taste or vision or smell, which again doesn't generally happen with syncope. Other things that are helpful to keep in mind, and generally you're getting a history from observers, not from the person themselves, but generally rhythmic or tonic-clonic movements are more specific to seizures. But, and this is important, Dr. Mohan, occasionally with syncope, you also can have that. With hyperperfusion of the brain, you can get tonic-clonic movement. So that in and of itself is not enough to distinguish. Now, other things. Syncope tends to be related to a quick return to normal function. And generally, people feel kind of fine. Having syncopized myself, generally the thing that is most notable when I come back is that I am embarrassed because I syncopized in front of people. And sometimes I'm bruised because I hit the ground. So those tend to be like those things after syncope, whereas with seizure, it tends to be longer. They tend to have a period afterwards when they come back where they will have confusion and fatigue, this postictal state. And they may have other things, like they may have bit their tongue and different types of injuries from that clenching of their jaw that happens with the seizure. And again, so longer loss of consciousness, pushing you more towards the seizure side. Syncope tends to be very brief loss of consciousness on the order of seconds. Now, Dr. Song calls out a kind of a neat tool in one of the articles that he was reading, the JAMA and JAMA, where there's the rotational clinical exam in 2019, which can help. It's a scoring system for teasing out seizure from syncope. And I won't go into detail. I'll direct all the listeners to check out the reader. But basically, there are kind of a number of historical, or rather, symptoms that can prompt you to think one versus the other. And again, I won't dive into that. Now, I'm going to get back to your original question, Dr. Mohan, the differential. So for true syncope, again, we're going to put seizure aside. But for true syncope, you're really kind of thinking between, could this be cardiovascular? Could it be neurologically mediated? Could it be orthostatic? Could it be psychogenic or pseudosyncope? And those are kind of your big buckets. Now, within the cardiovascular family, thinking about something that is going to compromise blood flow to the brain. And so you're thinking about structural heart disease, like the classic example is aortic stenosis. Then thinking about things like pulmonary embolisms, of course, again, will impair cardiac output and blood flow to the brain. And you're also thinking about kind of more devastating events like aneurysmal ruptures and things like that. Then we have neurologically mediated or neurally mediated syncope. And kind of the classic example of this is what we used to call vasovagal syncope, but that is kind of probably the most common one. But there are other ones like situational syncope. There's carotid sinus syncope, which is like overstimulation of the carotid bulb and the reflex that goes with it. But generally with neurologically mediated or neurally mediated syncope, the way to think about it is that you have increased vagal tone or decreased sympathetic tone. And so that leads to a decreased amount of blood flow to the brain and decreased cardiac output. Usually people get vasodilation in the extremities, which will cause that like flushed feeling. They'll get bradycardic and their systemic pressures will drop, so they get hypotension. And usually here, but not always, the syncope is preceded by vagal symptoms. So you get nausea, abdominal discomfort, or that diaphoresis. Now, a way to think about it, and the way I often explain it to patients, particularly with vasovagal syncope, is that it's a reflex and that it is the nerves that control blood flow get a little too excited. Generally, like for those who get it triggered by a sight of blood or something like a horror scene or something else that's really uncomfortable for them or something really embarrassing or traumatic, it is because that part of the nervous system that routes blood to the legs gets really turned on, and the part that's supposed to tell the heart to pump harder and send blood to the brain gets turned down and gets suppressed. Other ones, the situational syncope, for those who haven't heard of it, it's kind of a similar neurologically reflex mediated one, but it tends to be very predictable in terms of there's a specific stimuli like urination, cough, or defecation. And then carotid sinus syncope is one where, again, the carotid bulb gets pressure on it and is generally an anatomic thing with people, or like head rotation or shaving where they press over the carotids, where they wear really tight neckwear, like those turtlenecks, that can trigger it. Finally, I just want to go back one of the other things on our differential, orthostatic syncope. That's due to volume depletion. It's also related like postural hypotension, which can be due to meds and autonomic dysfunction. So you think about like your Parkinsonian patients or those patients that you and I put on too many medications. And of course, orthostatic syncope, we generally think of as true volume depletion. So that hot sunny day with those military folk who are standing in parade rest, and they just get volume depleted and they get that and they drop. So anyways, that was a rambling explanation of the differential.
Well, I think we covered some really good points with that. So now let's think about what historical and exam features would you focus on?
So the things that are really helpful here, the biggest one is history. So history, including a good exam with a cardiac exam and orthostatic vitals, can give you an initial diagnosis in like up to 66% of cases and has a diagnostic accuracy of 88%, which is really impressive. And by the way, part of our workup, which I will stress again in a few minutes, is that everybody with true syncope should get an EKG. That is a relatively inexpensive test that we can usually do in clinic. You can always do it in the ER. And it is, while often not going to give you the answer, it will occasionally identify the answer. And it usually is a very serious one when it does. So that is a key part of your workup, in addition to a history and thorough physical exam. Now on the history, what are you looking for? So you really want to get a sense of, is there a prodrome? Again, if there's an aura, you're thinking more seizure. Whereas if they're having anything else like diaphoresis, if they're feeling uncomfortable, if they are having some nausea or queasiness, you're pointing more towards the neurally mediated like vasovagal. If it happens predominantly with standing up all of a sudden, again, you're thinking orthostatic or postural hypotension. And on the other hand, if it's like a drop attack where they have no warning, and even if they're like sitting down and it just happens, you're thinking more likely cardiac syncope and that there's something happening with the blood flow that is triggered by the heart itself or a vascular issue. Other things you want to ask, is this triggered by something? Have they ever had it before? Like, did it happen with urination or coughing or defecation or exertion? Because if it's happening with exertion, that's pointing you towards the cardiac side. If they happen to wear really tight neckwear, and that's when it happens. Again, you're thinking more about that carotid sinus. And then, of course, you want to get a good cardiac and a neurologic history, thinking about things like, do they have any seizure risk factors? And of course, are they having chest pain with exertion? Do they have a history of aortic stenosis? Things like that. On your exam, what you're really looking for, again, is a really good cardiac exam, listening for murmurs. You are checking their orthostatic vital signs. And of course, you're listening for carotid bruise. And then you want a good neurologic exam. You don't want to miss the fact that someone probably just had a stroke. Like, if one side of their body, they're hemiplegic, you should identify that. Now, the ACC-AHA guidelines also identify kind of historical features in patients' health that also will point you towards thinking about cardiac syncope. So other things you want to be looking at when you're gathering your history is age. So age greater than 60, higher chance of cardiac syncope. Doesn't mean that it is for sure, but higher. Also male sex, more likely to be cardiac. If they have a history of cardiac disease, particularly ischemic heart disease or structural heart disease or arrhythmias. Of course, if you have the presence of pre-syncopal cardiac symptoms like palpitations. So if they feel like they're getting tachycardic, that should point you down the cardiac side. And of course, the sudden loss of consciousness, as I mentioned. If syncope happens during exertion, that is a red flag. Syncope when supine is also a red flag, because again, with the neurally mediated vasovagal side, if you're supine, that should actually address the issue and prevent syncope. Now, if they've only had like one event or two events, that also makes it more likely to be cardiac. If they have a family history of inheritable cardiac conditions or sudden cardiac death, should be thinking about cardiac causes for syncope. And then of course, if they have known congenital heart disease, and if on your exam you hear a raging 5 out of 6 murmur at the sternal border with radiation to the carotids. Now, on the other hand, things that make cardiac syncope less likely: younger age, lack of a cardiac history, syncope that occurs while changing position from supine to sitting or standing, because that's more likely to be neurally mediated or orthostatic. If they have those presyncopal symptoms I mentioned before, or if there's a specific trigger like dehydration or a particular painful or embarrassing stimuli or medical procedures, if they always pass out when we're drawing blood, that's probably not cardiac. So those are some of the things that should make you think cardiac syncope is less likely. And the reason I keep harping on cardiac syncope versus everything else is, as we all know, cardiac syncope, very dangerous. We're thinking about someone could have sudden cardiac death as the next time they present. So we really need to identify those cases, and we're going to treat those very differently.
All right. And I think very appropriate to be bringing that up, because that is very much the cannot miss source of syncope. So getting further into the case, your patient tells you he recalls not drinking much water that day. It was a hot day to be gardening. Prior to the event, he felt lightheaded, nauseated, and was sweating. He was kneeling, and he recalls trying to stand up when he passed out. His wife did not witness any rhythmic movements, and he regained consciousness quickly without any confusion. No palpitations, chest pain, dyspnea, or focal neurologic symptoms. On exam today in the office, his supine blood pressure is 124 over 70 with a pulse of 74. Immediately after standing, his blood pressure is 120 over 68 with a pulse of 80, and then 3 minutes later, his standing blood pressure is 130 over 74 with a pulse of 78. His cardiac and pulmonary exam are normal. He has no focal neurologic findings. So what is your initial workup? And does he need to go to the emergency department?
Well, I want to commend you. That is an excellent history and physical exam that you took. This is super, super suggestive for orthostatic hypotension. Now, the astute listener might be, well, those orthostatic vitals are not positive. Well, he waited to come in to see us. So presumably in the meantime, in the day since, he has hydrated himself and he is not sitting out in the sun, sweating too much and not drinking enough. Because this history, classic for orthostatic hypotension. Everything here fits really, really well. Again, he was outside in a hot day, wasn't drinking enough, so very likely had some degree of volume contraction. Then it happened when he stood up, and then he went down and he awoke and he wasn't having any other significant ongoing fatigue or other symptoms, other than presumably feeling embarrassed. And then his other history is generally pretty reassuring, and we have him on a thiazide diuretic, so he was more likely to be volume contracted. And the exam today is really reassuring. So in this case, we're really being pointed towards orthostatic and vasovagal syncope. Now, as I mentioned before, everybody with syncope gets an EKG. Like, that is your other diagnostic test that everybody just gets. It's about in 1 in 20 cases of syncope, that'll give you the answer, because the answer is a cardiac arrhythmia. Now, in his case, we still get the EKG, but already with the history, we're probably not worried about an arrhythmia. Now, routine labs generally aren't helpful, and you really want to use your history to point out when indeed you should be getting them. So if there's any reason you're worried about bleeding or other symptoms of anemia, then you should get a CBC, of course. If you're worried that they could be hyponatremic or have some other electrolyte abnormality, like they're hyperkalemic or hypokalemic, like they're on diuretics and they have chronic kidney disease or whatever, then it's reasonable to get a metabolic panel, of course. Generally speaking, you shouldn't be getting troponins in a BMP unless they're really having specific cardiac symptoms. And I know if someone walks in the emergency room door, they're getting all of that workup, but for you seeing them in clinic, again, if the history is pointing you strongly towards a one to direction and everything else is looking like it's probably basovagal, you don't need to get those labs. Now, you brought up, should this person go to the ED? Well, if you are worried about cardiac disease, a cardiac cause of syncope, and they need, like you're worried that this is an unstable disease, then it's very reasonable to send them to the emergency room for like that urgent workup. Particularly if you find on the EKG they have a new cardiac arrhythmia, or you hear a raging murmur and they've been having like this repeated syncope, then you're like, oh, I need to get you in immediately. If they're having exertional chest pain, right, we're thinking coronary disease. So it really is, if you're having other red flags, if they just got off an airplane from a 10-hour trip and one of their legs is swollen, pulmonary embolisms often present with syncope, then you need to send them to the ER pronto. But generally in this case, we're not getting any of that. The history is classic for vasovagal and orthostatic syncope. I wouldn't send them to the ER. That would be a waste of everybody's time and resources. But I would get the EKG, and if that is normal sinus rhythm, here we can be really confident, and then we just need to give them good anticipatory guidance for the future, which I think you'll probably ask me about in a moment.
Yes, so excellent plan. It sounds like the main thing we need to do for him is to get an EKG. And then, of course, the inevitable question that is probably going to come from, if not the patient, definitely his wife, who sounds like was quite worried, is going to be, how would you recommend to prevent and manage future episodes of syncope?
Yes. So thank you for asking, because when it's not cardiac syncope, when it's something like neurally mediated, we can do things that potentially will reduce the chance of injury in the future. And that's really how I think about it. So in the reader, Dr. Song has included a really nice table of advice that you can give. And I won't go through it in tons of detail, but I'm going to highlight a couple things. So when you've identified that it is a neurally mediated or orthostatic syncope, so volume contraction or that neurally mediated, what you want to do is you want to give them guidance on when they're going to be likely to have another event and what they can do to prevent it. So for those of us who've had neurally mediated, who have a prodrome, once you've had it, you should be able to recognize if you're going to get it again. Like you'll feel that sweating, they'll feel that diaphoretic sense. And the best thing they can do is to get close to the ground. So sit down, lie down, or even squatting, but get close to the ground. And this accomplishes two things. The first is if they syncopize, they will take less damage because they'll be closer to the ground. The second thing is the act of sitting down itself may just break the syncopal attack that is coming, because you're going to get increased blood flow back up to the brain. That act of squatting or sitting is going to help improve venous blood flow return to the heart, which will help, of course, with forward blood flow up to the brain. The other things they can do is that if they can put their feet up in the air, again, you get that nice return of blood to the heart. Very, very helpful. Other things you can do, which will take a little bit more training, is you can teach them some of the counterpressure maneuvers that will help. These are things like squeezing your hands, tensing your calves, that improves, again, venous return to the heart. I will say I don't try to teach my patients these things unless they keep having these events in spite of doing the other steps. Because generally when the syncope is coming, part of what your body is feeling is decreased blood flow to the brain, and the brain is not working well in that setting. So if they just keep one thing in there, which is get to the ground, that is enough. Other things that you can do, if they keep syncopizing and your cardiac workup remains reassuring, is you can recommend that they use compression stockings, particularly if there's an orthostatic component that they wear all the time to help push that venous blood flow back to the brain, and really push fluids every day. Like that they are hitting like 2 liters of a non-caffeinated fluid like water. And you can give them guidance of keeping their urine looking pretty clear, and that is the signal to them that they're getting enough hydration. Now, for those who can't see us, Dr. Mohan and I are consuming caffeinated beverages as we speak, and we're looking at this and realizing maybe we should be having more water. Now, other things, if someone continues to have carotid sinus syncope or really vigorous, aggressive, neurally mated syncope that nothing else is working, you're going to send them to a specialist. And there are settings where you might look at things like pacemakers, even though it is not cardiac syncope. But that is very much refractory symptoms, and I've sent them to cardiology, and cardiology has kind of done all of this, and we're out of options. So hopefully that helps, Dr. Mohan.
Yes, definitely. And I think one of the really nice points that they made is that it is definitely 2 liters before lunchtime, which I think a lot of us will recommend for our patients, 64 ounces, 2 liters by the end of the day. But really trying to get it in that first half of the day is very critical, which I think for a lot of people, is not often our habit. So that's actually a really good point to make with them. So let's change gears. We're going to do a different case. So you have a 72-year-old patient, comes for a routine follow-up of diabetes. She tells you that 2 days ago she was walking her dog when she developed palpitations and slight shortness of breath, and then felt lightheaded and then passed out. She awoke right away. Other than the dog, there were no witnesses who could actually give us a history. Maybe someday we'll have some means of getting a history from a pet, but sadly not today. No tongue biting. She has noted recently that her exercise tolerance has decreased with more shortness of breath with exertion. She has a history of hypertension, type 2 diabetes, and hyperlipidemia, takes metformin, empagliflozin, losartan, and rosuvastatin, and her Ryu systems is otherwise normal. On exam, she is in no distress. Blood pressure is 146 over 84, pulse of 86, and orthostatic blood pressures are normal. Lungs are clear. She has a 2 out of 6 systolic murmur, loudest at the right upper sternal border. She has no edema and a normal neuro exam. You order an EKG, and she has LVH by voltage criteria, which is unchanged from her prior EKG. So in this case, how are you going to approach the differential and workup?
So very different case. And I will agree with you. In the future, we may be able to get history from pets, although I'd be fascinated what the dog was thinking about when she went down. Dog might have been thinking about the fire hydrant across the street, so it might not actually be that helpful of a history. Anyways, getting back to your question, a very important one. So we have, we start with the same differential, but we have a lot of pieces here that are pointing us very quickly towards a cardiac syncopal cause. Again, there's no prodromal with aura, but there is a prodrome that is concerning. So again, we're not looking at a seizure very likely. Again, she comes to really quick, but her prodrome was shortness of breath and palpitations. Again, those are prodromal symptoms that are more suggestive for cardiac. Don't tell you for sure cardiac, but they're more suggestive. Now, her age is over 60. Again, another red flag. She definitely has cardiovascular risk factors, and she literally has a murmur on exam, and she has an abnormal EKG with LVH. So at this point, I'm thinking high suspicion for cardiac syncope. I have to rule that out at the bare minimum. And so really my decision point in this is, how urgent is this workup? Like, can I do it as an outpatient if I can get it done the next few days, or do I need to send her to the emergency room because I can't get it done? So I occasionally see patients in rural settings in my current practice, and generally it is hard to get them outpatient workup expedited. So depending on where they are, this might be a very excellent one to send to the ER. And in terms of thinking what could be causing this cardiac syncope, or what would be the actual specific etiology, I'd be worried about valvular disease, as well as an arrhythmia, as well as ischemic heart disease. Like, she has factors that would point us to each of those three things. So she needs an echocardiogram and probably needs a stress test at the minimum, and potentially more advanced imaging. And yeah, so if I could get those done in the next day or two as an outpatient, I might do that. Otherwise, I'm going to send her to the ER.
All right. Thank you for also reviewing your breakdown of what's going to pull your trigger for sending someone to the hospital. That is an excellent point. So next case, you've got a 32-year-old man, comes for a follow-up evaluation of recurrent syncope. He has had 6 events in the past 2 years. The events are similar in nature, associated with a prodrome of mild abdominal pain, nausea, and diaphoresis. The events occur with change in position from sitting to standing. Medical history is significant for depression, and his only medication is citalopram at 20 milligrams daily. He has no symptoms suggestive of cardiac disease or family history of early cardiac disease. Prior evaluation for syncope included admission to the hospital with no evidence of arrhythmia on telemetry, a normal EKG and lab testing, and a normal echo. So now what's your differential diagnosis and workup for this patient with recurrent syncope?
Great. So again, we are given a lot of elements that are reassuring. We have a young person. We don't have any cardiac risk factors, as you tell us. And this happens with sitting to standing, so that change in position. There is a prodrome that is more suggestive of a neurally mediated. So at this point, I'm thinking very likely to be vasovagal, potentially with an overlapping orthostatic syncope. And the other thing, if these events keep happening and we've had a thorough inpatient workup, it's reasonable to think about a behavioral health component like pseudosyncope. And as always, there is the potential that this is more serious etiology that's just being missed, like cardiac syncope. But again, we're really getting a reassuring history here. And it sounds like they've had a very thorough workup for cardiac syncope. So that's really reassuring. So anyways, I'm thinking vasovagal, potentially plus or minus orthostatic syncope, my primary leading explanation at this point. Now, this kind of leads to, what other testing can we do to confirm that? And this is hard. So while we can work up cardiac syncope in a lot of different ways, for example, if you have someone that you're worried about cardiac syncope, you can put them on an ambulatory rhythm monitor in addition to looking for structural heart disease with an echocardiogram. And if they have infrequent syncopal events and you don't happen to catch anything on your ambulatory cardiac monitor patch, the 7 or 14 day one, that, like, for example, is used at Virginia Mason, you can do things like implanted loop recorders that can stay in for up to several years. And I've had, I think, 2 patients where the diagnosis was made because of that implanted loop recorder, because of how infrequent. Now, getting back to, if we have a high suspicion for vasovagal syncope, how do you test for that? Well, there is a test. It's not a great test. It is called the tilt table test. And I'd love to see a show of hands about if anyone has ordered this. When I was back in training, it was more common years ago, but it's a crummy test. And sorry, I know that is a pejorative term that I used there. But tilt table testing is when you literally have someone on a table that they are strapped to, and then the table, which is usually an engine or motorized, takes them from being supine to 70 degrees upright rather rapidly while you are monitoring their heart rhythm and their pulse rate, and you're looking for changes in beat-to-beat blood pressure and changes in their heart rate. And basically, in vasovagal syncope, they can become symptomatic, and you can see a drop in heart rate, and there's a definition about how much, or a drop in blood pressure, which the numbers are kind of greater than orthostatic syncope, and you need to be raising them rapidly and measuring that very closely to do this test correctly. Now, the fascinating thing about tilt table testing is we can make anyone syncopize depending on how rapidly you go up with the table and the angle to which you take it, which is one of the downsides to this testing. Now, you can use medications like isoproterenol to increase the heart rate, basically to help trigger it, or give them nitroglycerin to like get more venous pooling in the legs. And so if you use medications, you can make this test more sensitive, although a little less specific because you're using medicines that can precipitate this in anyone. But basically, tilt table testing without medicines, 25% sensitive, 99% specific. So again, not a great test in many different ways, but when you have a positive result, at least it is more confirming that they are vulnerable to vasovagal syncope. And basically, if you add medications to it, you can increase the sensitivity, but you drop the specificity. Now, so that's something you can do if you have a strong suspicion for vasovagal syncope. And I don't think Virginia Mason even does tilt table testing anymore. So you'd be sending them outside to,
have to refer to UW.
Yes, we send them to University of Washington. So anyways, that is something we could consider here. And as I mentioned before, if you still have a suspicion for cardiac, particularly in arrhythmia, you can do those longer ambulatory rhythm monitors to try to catch something that's an infrequent event. Now, in this case, again, the patient is not having any cardiac symptoms or risk factors. You could consider tilt table testing if you need that further reassurance, or you just move forward with, I have a strong suspicion this is vasovagal syncope, and we really need to be aggressive about those preventative maneuvers.
All right. I think that was an excellent review of syncope, going through the various causes that we commonly see in primary care for syncope, how to evaluate it, how to manage it, and what to do with some of those more stubborn cases as well. So thank you so much for sharing some excellent teaching and excellent practical pearls on how to apply everything.
Oh, it is my privilege and pleasure. Thank you, Dr. Mohan.
All right. Have a good day, everyone.
Bye.